So a little bit of review on the nature of dukkha. And I'll talk about dukkha in general and then talk about the connection between dukkha and delusion, and then talk about social dukkha. Then talk about social dukkha and delusion, and then what we should do. Okay, that's my outline. And I have a lot to say. I probably could stay for another hour or two, but I'll try to be brief and not say too much. So remember that, this is from last time, that we could summarize the entire teachings of the Buddha, and I think in some ways 2,600 years of tradition, by pointing to one statement that the Buddha made: I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. Last time I unpacked some the nature of dukkha, usually translated as suffering, pointing out the many ways that there can be a lot of confusion about what this means. So what is dukkha? What is the end of dukkha? Last time I mentioned that there are at least four different understandings of dukkha in the suttas. And I'll give four of them, and only the fourth of them makes sense of what the end of dukkha is, which is really the goal of our practice. That's what's pointed to by the third noble truth. So the first sense of dukkha, which is aligned often with the translation of dukkha as suffering, is of dukkha as what is painful or unpleasant. That's where the Buddha says old age is dukkha, illness is dukkha, death is dukkha. And understanding dukkha as the unpleasant can be helpful, perhaps, and it's certainly one of the traditional meanings, but it doesn't help us with making sense of what the end of dukkha means. Because if we're looking for freedom or liberation, we don't find it in the end of what's painful or unpleasant. That is part of human life. And so the end of dukkha is not the end of dukkha in the first sense. In a similar way, there's a second meaning of dukkha, which is that everything that is pleasant will eventually become unpleasant. But again, that is more like a truism about life, and that sense of dukkha doesn't end. So the end of dukkha doesn't make sense according to that account of dukkha. In a similar way, there's a third sense of dukkha called sankhara dukkha, which is that nothing that is conditioned in our experience, really nothing that we find in our experience, is capable of giving lasting satisfaction. And that is why life is dukkha. Nothing can give us lasting satisfaction. And this, while an important teaching, doesn't get at what the end of dukkha means, because that is simply the way things are. And that sense of dukkha doesn't end. Perhaps we don't believe that things can give us lasting satisfaction, but that teaching in itself doesn't really make such good sense of the end of dukkha. And so I like to point to the teaching that's probably my favorite teaching, which I give a lot, the teaching of the two arrows, in which it's pretty clear that dukkha could be translated as reactivity. And this is, in the text, it's that there one sometimes has an unpleasant experience or painful experience, which the Buddha calls the first arrow. and says that because of the first arrow, people at times try to get rid of it by shooting a second arrow. So that would be something difficult happens to me and I blame myself or I blame someone else. Something, I have a difficult emotion and I make up a negative story and get fixated on it. I have an unpleasant sensation in my body and I tense around it. And these would all be forms of reactivity in which we push away. I believe this is getting at the core teaching of what dukkha and the end of dukkha means. I like to talk about dukkha in that sense as reactivity and say in a very, using very simple English words, that the meaning of our practice is ending reactivity and becoming responsive moment by moment. That's it. That's a very ordinary English way of talking about our practice. The other piece that is important to add that's not there in the translation of dukkha as suffering is that there are two forms of reactivity. There's the pushing away and there's the grasping. And we want to look at and work with both forms of reactivity. And so in each of the areas of our practice, we can work with dukkha. We can do that in various ways. We can, when the dukkha is in the workable range, we can be mindful of our reactivity. We can look into the dynamics and notice how in the form of reactivity that's based on grasping after the pleasant, we can actually locate, oh, there's what's pleasant, here's what I'm grasping after. In a similar way, we can notice how when we experience the unpleasant, we can notice a reactivity that may tend to develop if we're not mindful. Sometimes we can notice reactivity and we don't even know what's pleasant or unpleasant that's driving it. And some of our practice is actually to come in touch with that. We can also, if we're working with a lot of reactivity, we can work with loving kindness or compassion or empathy that helps us stay balanced when we're working with reactivity. And we can learn how to develop non-reactivity. Mindfulness is a form of non-reactivity. And we can increasingly bring this into daily life and into our work in the world. So I'm giving what could be an hour-long talk, which I've just finished. Right? So just giving this summary of the nature of dukkha and how we practice with dukkha so we can, again, learn how to be non-reactive in the flow of daily life. Notice reactivity when I become judgmental or upset or irritated, and notice the dynamics. Notice how that arises interpersonally. And a lot of what we offer in speech and communication practice is learning ways to be with situations in which we're reactive and learn how to be non-reactive interpersonally, how to do that more easily, how to work with difference, conflict, times when I become reactive. And then, I'll come later to how we then bring that into the world. So that's right at the center of our practice, working with dukkha, opening to it, transforming it, seeing what other practices support us in transforming dukkha, learning how to do that with our individual minds and our relational lives, and then increasingly in our community work, action-oriented lives. Now, I wanted to make an addition here that I didn't go into last time that I think is quite important. And that is that dukkha is closely related to delusion or ignorance. And many of us know this by reflecting on the teaching of what are called the three poisons. which are greed, hatred, and delusion. Well, if we look to what greed and hatred are, they're really forms of the two kinds of reactivity. Greed is grabbing after what we like, what we think is pleasant, and hatred or aversion, different ways of talking about the second poison, is really a form of the reactivity in which we push away the unpleasant. And so important to see that that these are both connected with delusion, that there's some kind of misunderstanding that we have when we're reactive. And a lot of it is at a very fundamental, relatively unconscious level. There's some part of us which believes that being reactive is a way to become happy. Again, if I phrase it like that, you won't sign up for it, right? But if I phrase it another way, it's maybe more familiar. Another way to say it is that we believe that grasping after what we want can bring us happiness. Again, if we reflect on it, we might not think so, but what does our action tell us? What does our behavior tell us? The same thing with being reactive through pushing something away, being aversive. Not necessarily hating something, but being aversive maybe through being judgmental. There's at least a part of us that believes that this is the way to find happiness. And yet part of us also knows, if we've been practicing, that there's pointed to a deeper sense of happiness, which is precisely the happiness of non-reactivity. We could use different language to talk about it. It's the happiness of freedom or responsiveness or love, wisdom, knowing ourselves as Ramdas used to say, knowing ourselves as loving awareness and responding out of love, compassion, and wisdom in our day-to-day lives and in the different areas of our practice. I think I wanted to maybe a little more specific about how reactivity is connected with delusion. So for example, we look at greed. And I'm thinking now about something I think I've talked about from time to time here at the Marin Sangha, which was a class that Diana Winston and I led probably 18 to 20 years ago. And this was a class that we called Greed Management. We had extremely low enrollment in the class. To be precise, we had 2 teachers and 5 students. But we didn't care. Diana and I didn't care. We really were interested in the topic. So we had a 5-week class, and the final exam was doing silent walking meditation for 30 minutes in the newly opened El Cerrito Bed Bath & Beyond, and then comparing notes. And so what we found in the greed management class, I think, can really make clear, assuming we were accurate, about how greed is connected with delusion. That's the point I'm making. What we found was that although there could be something helpful in what we were greedy after, there was also a great deal of delusion. We found that greed was typically compulsive and relatively unconscious. I need to do this. And there's almost like there's very little consciousness at moments of greed. Another aspect of greed was that there was typically, this came from all of us looking over 5 weeks into our experience, typically no cognizance of the consequences. In moments of greed, it was like, I want this, I need this, without thinking about consequences, without thinking about other people. Other people's needs do not matter. So also really not seeing interdependence. And there's a similar way in which we can notice the reactivity of pushing away as connected with delusion. And I've looked at this especially through exploring what I call the judgmental mind, you know, and in myself and in many others over a lot of years. And what we find is that typically, particularly our most regular examples of being judgmental towards ourselves or others, typically are driven by a kind of unprocessed or unacknowledged pain. You know, I may judge myself very harshly, and there's some way that this is coming from some automatic process, often which dates back to childhood conditioning. It could be perfectionism, could be something like that, where I'm driven to be harsh and judge myself harshly, but often I'm not even aware that there's some pain. So in a curious way, the judgmental mind is a defense mechanism against feeling pain. And so we actually don't even know what's happening. And we're typically driven by relatively unconscious limiting beliefs, like I need to be perfect to get love or be happy. And we can also see this, I think we could see this also in the example of race and racism that we looked at in June, that again, scientists tell us that race is a kind of an illusion, it has no basis. And so people who are racist, if we remember from what we looked at, it's basically a system devised by the wealthy elites to manipulate people so they can have power, right? And so there's a vast amount of delusion. People don't realize the divide and conquer dimension of racism and take it personally and buy into all sorts of crazy ideas. And so we can come back to that. And so, you know, where does delusion come from? I think it comes from three really main sources. In traditional Buddhist practice, delusion comes because we don't see clearly the nature of things. And it's especially understood as not seeing impermanence, not seeing dukkha itself, and not seeing the nature of the self. From the Buddha, warped perceptions are what keep your mind on fire. Delusion burns the bewildered, unaware of the noble Dhamma. And then this is from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a dialogue between Martha and George. Truth or illusion, George, you don't know the difference. George, no, but we must carry on as though we did. Martha, amen. So there's a kind of ignorance about the nature of ourselves, the nature of our deep minds. This is from a Tibetan text called The Prayer of Kuntizampo. In the beginning, delusion arises in sentient beings. When awakened, non-dual awareness does not arise. The mind becomes numb and dull. The failure to recognize our own awakened awareness is the first ignorance and the cause of every ill. Instantly unconscious, one's thoughts wander aimlessly. One is seized by hope and fear. This begets the duality of I and other, friend and enemy. And through clinging, this becomes habitual. Descending from that comes samsara and the increasing afflictions of the five poisons. There is no end to this activity. So part of delusion is not being awake, not having awakened awareness, not seeing the nature of things. And I think we can also bring in two sources of delusion that are more seen in contemporary ways. One of these is our psychological conditioning, our family conditioning. much like I was talking about the judgmental mind, we have beliefs that arise when we're young. And, you know, even in the best of circumstances, the best of parents, there are ways in which parts of ourselves, you know, it's almost as if when we're quite young, there's a certain kind of wholeness there. And in our experience, we come up against, sometimes in the family, sometimes in the people around us, people telling us this part of yourself is not okay. And so we, in a sense, reduce ourselves. We lose that wholeness, and we find, rather than being a kind of a whole being grounded in love, we look for substitute gratifications. And we say, if I behave in this way, I'll get gratification from this person. It might be the parent, might be people around us. Most of us don't lose those impulses for love and wisdom, but most of us as practitioners have both happening. We have the residues of ways in which we're partly shut down, and parts of ourselves from an early age have not been okay. So we really can't be fully ourselves. And a lot of psychological work points that out. And there's something similar which happens with social conditioning. Again, these areas, I think we can have better understanding with contemporary ways of seeing. So, you know, we also all receive social conditioning, which again, creates what one of my teachers calls kind of the fragmentation of the individual. You know, if I'm a man, a boy, I learn, you know, it's changing some now, but I certainly had to learn how not to be emotional. You know, how to not have access to my emotions, my bodies. We fragment off and we lose touch. Some of this comes again from the family setting, some from the, you know, the community, some from social conditioning. The biggest ones are around gender, race, age, ability, and so forth. You know, so, and there, I think we all have a certain amount of confusion about that. I know I was reflecting on growing up and going to school with Black kids in the part of Maryland where I lived. I was confused when I would go into the almost exclusively Black area and see the unpaved streets and see the shacks often. And there was just some confusion. How is this life? So I think most of us go through something like this where our inherent probably goodness and love gets fragmented. Right. And this is connected. I think this is related to why we have reactivity, why we have dukkha. So you can see some of the roots of social dukkha. I've already named some of them in our conditioning. And we can see how, for example, greed gets institutionalized, and greed and grabbing gets institutionalized, particularly in the economic system, you know, particularly with the great divides between the wealthy and the rest of the people. During the pandemic, Jeff Bezos has an additional $50 billion in his account now. He's up to $200 billion, right? And at the same time, 40 million Americans filed for unemployment. So we have these, we have a system, you know, that seems to reward greed. There's also, we could see it very much here. I'll sound a little partisan, but I'm critical of both the Democrats and Republicans. But we could look at the Republican National Convention and see something like, we've been seeing for a long time, a kind of greed for power and a sense that they're willing to do anything, including subvert democracy, to gain power, right? Seems to be something like that, to violate the law, go after democratic norms. You know, I think of the current president's sister, who said, you know, it was recorded, I think, by her niece, he has no principles, right? The only principle is power. We can also see how hatred and aversion get institutionalized. You know, again, if we look to the way that racism has been expressed in the last 50 years after it was no longer fashionable to be overtly racist, it takes the shape of what? Talking about law and order or the inner cities or riots. Again, these are in technical terms called dog whistles. People know what these are about. And so we can see also the link of these with delusion, that social dukkha is very much linked with delusion. I talked about how racism has a very strong basis in delusion. And we can see again how, I mean, my experience of tuning into the Republican National Convention, it seems like an alternative reality separate from ordinary reality, right? Again, I'm trying not to be partisan, because I would criticize the Democrats also for following the dog whistle politics, you know, in the past, not I think at the current time. And so I could probably go on. A lot of this is familiar to you, just the loss of ethics, the propping up of the authoritarian leader and so forth. And so there's a very strong element of delusion, of people giving up contact with reality. And so how to respond, and maybe I could talk more in depth about this another time. I'll just be brief. I've been very drawn, and I've mentioned this sometimes, to the powerful parallels between the traditions of nonviolence, particularly of Gandhi and King, and the teachings of the Buddha. You could interpret nonviolence as another version of the teaching of the two arrows. And this is saying we will respond to social injustice, but we will not pass on the pain. And so we will develop, as it were, non-reactive ways of responding to and transforming reactivity. In the language of Dr. King, this was expressed as the movement being based on love, of coming from love. So, you know, this is related to the Buddha talking in the Dhammapada. Hatred never ends through hatred, but only by love does it end. King saying, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds. And King said that love is the center of our movement. It is this whole ethic of love, he said, which is the idea sustaining, standing at the basis of the movement. And he had to work with anger. So part of the transforming of social dukkha is working with anger. A lot of people are motivated by anger. Many social justice movements motivated by anger. But someone like King said, at the heart of our movement is the transformation of anger. Cornel West said of Dr. King, he concluded that Black rage was so destructive and self-destructive that without a broad moral vision and political organization, Black rage would wreak havoc on Black America. His project of nonviolent resistance to white racism was an attempt to channel Black rage in political directions that preserved Black dignity and changed American society. And so the transformation of anger, working with reactivity at the center of things. Maybe just one or two further things to say, that there's a way they think that when when, particularly when white people join in a movement like this, like join in a movement against racism, I think there's something like an inner healing, because part of what racism is internally is keeping that inner split going, you know, that split between that part of us which wants love, which wants to have a society that is based on connection and based on care. And when we make moves, particularly as white people, towards that kind of movement, I think there's an inner healing which also occurs. There's a kind of healing that occurs. And so the movement is both trying to change particular institutions or structures, and also I think there's a healing process that occurs. That, you know, action has a healing dimension, not just countering what's wrong. And that's particularly if we act with love and have that love at the center of action. So I'll end with something that I gave at the Climate Day Long from John Lewis, who just died last month, when he talked about the centrality of love in action, which is really another way to talk about this. That's what non-reactivity in action is, love and wisdom in action. So this is what John Lewis said. I'll end with this. When we were sitting in, it was love in action. When we went on the Freedom Ride, it was love in action. The march from Selma to Montgomery was love in action. We do it not simply because it's the right thing to do, but it's love in action. That we love our country. We love a democratic society. And so we have to move our feet. So thank you for listening to my reflections. It's a large area, but I hope I touched on some pieces that can make some connections between dukkha and delusion, and then seeing the different ways that there's also social dukkha that gets institutionalized, how it's connected with delusion, and then very briefly some of the ways that we can start to address this. So thank you, and let me just take a moment to invite us to sit quietly. See what was helpful, see where there's a question. I could have gone on for a longer time. I had more material I didn't go through, but I wanted to ensure time for discussion. So any thoughts, questions, reflections? Could be on any aspect of dukkha and the end of dukkha. Hey, Bill, please.
Yes, you recited something from a Tibetan teacher that sounded suspiciously like a dependent origination. Cyclist started in ignorance. Could you give us his name again?
This is a text called The Prayer of Kuntzasampo. And I think I don't remember the name of the author it's attributed to. Let me see if I have the reference. There's a book that gives a translation of the text. I've studied the text. Let's see.
It's a lovely text, and it sounds like a form of dependent origination.
Yeah.
There are many different forms of dependent origination. The Buddha kept on returning to that cause and effect cycle.
Yeah, this is more like, I think there are six or seven different steps, but it's a way that when we lose what in that particular tradition is called awakened awareness, the kind of a non-dual awareness, which is the aim of many of the Tibetan traditions, particularly Dzogchen and Mahamudra, that there's a kind of falling away from that. I mean, in, we could say probably in Western language, it would be being in touch with God or being in touch with the spirit, that there's a falling away from that, you know, or I think of in some of the Jewish mystical traditions, it said that there was originally this great light, but it got shattered and sent into 1,000 pieces, right? So there's some way that we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. There's some way that we lose contact with the sacred or the divine. And then out of that, there are further developments where we develop, where we basically become reactive. Out of that comes a opposition between self and other. And as it were, a lot of the forms of dukkha appear. So yeah, it's a sequence like that, and it's said that somehow we lose touch with, again, we could use neutral language and call it the sacred. Yeah. It's called the Prayer of Kuntsampo. It's in a book of a different title, but if you look that up, you can find it. It's a pretty powerful text. It's really a text about compassion, actually. It's an extended compassion practice. In the text, one goes to all the different realms, which is one of the Tibetan models. You go to all the different realms and you manifest compassion towards beings in all the different realms. That's what the text is in its core. Yeah, others, anything related to dukkha, social dukkha, how we practice, please, Liz. Liz had a hand up, and then yes. Mary. Yeah.
I really enjoyed your assignment of watching my reactivity this week.
Yeah.
I've never done that before. And I know that you've probably taken that on. You do amazing practices when you take on something like that. I know you do things like for a year or two or 6 months. But I think it would be very, very, I would really look forward to doing this practice for a long time.
Yeah.
Of watching my reactivity. And it was surprising, actually.
Go ahead.
It was surprising, and I have a lot of impatience, which I noticed. So that was wonderful, and I really want to keep on with this practice for a couple of months, I think.
That's great, and maybe you can check in with anyone else interested in doing that. You can check in. Yeah, look at the hands that are up, and maybe you can connect with each other. Okay,
I didn't see who's
hands. See, I see Deborah, Linda, yeah. I see Marianne, who else? Well, Linda, again.
Well, it was a very valuable practice, and I thank you.
It's very powerful, and it's also very simple. And we can do it, maybe if you have a half-hour sitting, you can stabilize the first half of the sitting, and then the last half of the sitting, look for reactivity when you're sitting, even small stuff, right? It's very, very interesting. And then set your intention to look for reactivity during the day, in the morning. Let me check out reactivity. And, maybe you look especially for the bigger examples, but after a while, you also see the small stuff.
Well,
again, reactivity is both the grabbing hold and the pushing away. For most of us, the pushing away is a little easier to see.
I just saw it with some friends that I care about very much.
Yeah.
Who are troubled, and I have to listen to them. And I saw myself getting reactive.
Yeah.
Which is not something I want to do. And that was very, very good to notice. And so I stopped it. And I became more patient and just devoted myself to listening to them.
That's great. And the other side is if we are spending time going into reactivity, it's good to have a practice which is, as the Buddha says, gladdening the mind. So it could be metta or compassion or being with beauty, because continually, okay, I'm just looking at reactivity for 2 months. Right? We want to also go to the joyful and the beautiful.
Absolutely. That's
important. Mary, please.
So my question is kind of the distinction between feeling the sorrow and the pain.
Yeah.
So an example that I've been just really absorbed with reading a lot on the history of racism in this country.
Right.
I'm reading many of the books. And at a certain point, it becomes just excruciatingly painful to read the amount of it. And so is the reactivity, I mean, it seems like it's appropriate to feel the sorrow and the grief.
That's right.
That where is the reactivity? Is the reactivity, at what point does it become reactive? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, that's right. So again, this is where we go back to the model of dependent origination. The core part of it, very simple. There is a contact with some experience. Out of that comes the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And so you're in contact with some reading and a painful experience occurs. Could be sadness, could be anger. And that in itself is not reactive. It's the some kind of pushing away that ensues. It might be, it could be despair. It could be forming a negative narrative about the country. You know, it could be coming to cynicism. Now, those would all be examples of reactivity. It could be feeling overwhelmed and just feeling out of balance. You know, some way. I'm not sure. There, maybe that could be just being with pain can sometimes be overwhelming. But you want to look particularly for some way that you're pushing it away. Often mentally, it should often have a mental aspect. So does that make some sense? Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And even your talk tonight about bringing in John Lewis and King, I could feel the kind of some joy returning.
Yeah. Again, much as I said with Liz, you know, if you're reading so much in those texts, you know, it's good to also tune into the positives or read about the legacy of those who have been sort of heroes, heroines, the champions, you know, and balance it, you know, or could be just balancing it with, like what I mentioned, with that doing that which gladdens the heart. I think we had one other person had a hand up. Anyone else?
All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of add to that because when you were talking, it made me think of when I get into those places of like being really overwhelmed by racism or something, I think the dependent origination aspect happens when I turn it into the world. I make the whole world that way. You know, it's like, everyone's racist, so no one, you da 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 da, and it can get very, very, it's like a downward spiral.
That's right. There's some kind of, I think overwhelm can still be at the level of the pain or the emotion, but there then is sort of a mental addition, or I've sometimes taught on the ladder of inference where you go up the ladder, you make a certain generalization, consciously or unconsciously. Oh, the whole world's like this. Oh, this is hopeless. That's reactivity, right? The sense, and it can come out of the sense of overwhelm, which is still, I think, at the level of the Vedana or the pleasant or unpleasant, but it's just very hard to hold. And that can lead us to generalizing. But so look for that mental addition or the narrative. That's going to be really crucial. You know, the narrative plays such a crucial role in reactivity. You know, whether it's a personal narrative, being judgmental towards myself or not being perfect or having this aspect of my life not quite right, there's going to be some storyline. And we wanted that so much of the work of working with reactivity is tuning in and recognizing that storyline or the narrative that's so crucial in all these examples. Yeah. Maybe time for one more and then we'll finish up. Yeah, Deborah, please. You have to unmute, Deborah.
Sorry, and thank you. I've really been enjoying your talks. They're a blessing, and I want to say thank you. And I want to add that I kind of thought I had a pretty good mindfulness of the body practice because I have a couple of pain syndromes going on in my body. But after you're talking about it, I decided to up my game. And it's been really helpful. And what I've noticed that in noticing more often and letting go and being in my breath and being in my body that many more times or longer minutes a day, it's helped me to be way more patient this week in particular with some family members I've been having more interactions with. And all of it's very joyful. It's really joyful to stay more spacious and more grounded and to be able to be much more loving to these relatives. Well, they're more than relatives, they're family.
Yeah.
So I wanted to share that and I wanted to say thank you.
Thanks, Deborah. That's, so crucial. Mindfulness of body is so powerful. Again, a lot of what we're talking about is how we can get sometimes caught in the narratives or the workings of the mind, you know, which have their, of course, helpful aspect. But when we can come and be in our body, we can often not be so taken by those narratives. Right?
And relative to dukkha, it's much easier to increase spaciousness around pain.
Yeah.
When I'm able to just stay calm, stay equanimous, change my posture, be with my breath, and just practice some acceptance and gratitude for what my body's still able to do. And then to be able to alleviate some of the suffering for these couple of relatives, I'm having a lot of interaction. They're going through some transitions. To be able to be there for them and to be loving and supportive and allow them to feel more safe. It's great. Thank you.
It's wonderful. Good to hear about that. Yeah, I didn't bring in too much on mindfulness of the body, but it's very, very helpful for all of what we've been exploring.
Thank you.